What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning into the Producers Corner with Spud Too Tight. And again, I have another hot show for you today. On the phone with me, I have a very talented jazz guitarist. With his blend of smooth jazz and rock, he has made a name for himself in smooth jazz circuits, becoming a very popular session guitarist on numerous high-profile projects. Please put your hands together and welcome jazz guitarist and composer, Drew Davidson. How's it going, Drew?
It's doing awesome. I'm loving life.
Oh,
we are thanking BMI today. So,
oh, nice, good deal.
I always wondered if I filled that stuff out correctly. You know, for years I never saw anything. One time I saw $32, but today we saw a nice little something to help with the promoting we've been doing. So it's encouraging.
Oh, there you go, man. Keep the wheels moving.
Yeah, man.
Well, Drew, man, thank you so much for coming on the show and chopping it up with me one on one, man. You know, I've listened to your website on the tracks you have on your website, man. It's just phenomenal, the stuff you're doing on the guitar. I play guitar a little bit also, and, you know, it's always an honor for me to see somebody that's really as seasoned as you are, man. Truly phenomenal, man.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I've been a student of the game. I discovered, I was a little late to discover George Benson, but in the Navy, in the early 90s, I heard this Breezing cassette and got really infatuated with his clean sound. And I've just been studying him forever. George Benson, Lee Ritenour, Larry Carlton, all those guys.
Oh, yeah, there you go, the veterans.
Yeah, you know, if you want to be great at something, you have to ingest your body with the greats. So my newest thing now is this Lee Ritenour song called Mr. Briefcase from 1984. I never go to bed without listening to that song. It's such an amazing live recording. It beats the pants off of these guys that play live today that need extra synthesizers and all this. It's just a band playing. With a Yamaha DX7, you know.
Oh, yeah, no, I agree with you, man. You know, when something is as timeless as some of the songs that you mentioned, some of the players that you mentioned earlier, man, these guys can, you can pull back these songs from the 80s, and it still sounds great today where you want to pick up some of their chops. You know, and these guys are doing back in the 80s, man. I mean, they're just so ahead of their time, and it's just, you know, the relevancy is just, it's always going to be current as far as their sound.
Well, this Lee Ritenour tune I discovered has Phil Perry singing vocals. And, you know, he sings with Foreplay and all that. And it's just, it's great. So I try to listen to a lot of great music every night before I go to bed. It's the last thing I do. I fall asleep, put YouTube on, and I just search out great musicians and try to ingest my body with it and then fall asleep dreaming about playing guitar.
Oh, there you go, man. So, Drew, give me a little background of how when you started in the music business and also evolving into a seasoned musician like you are.
Yeah, what I did, I did play music as a kid. I was a cello player. I took home a cello in the third grade, told my father I wanted to play cello. I think it was really they didn't have any cellists, and I sort of volunteered. But I liked the cello. My father was musical. We always had instruments around the house. It wasn't really till the Navy. In high school, I played bass and a little cover band, and we did some original music, and that was a lot of fun. But in the Navy, I really grew fond of music. I realized how much I missed doing it. You know, you go to boot camp, you go to the ship, and you don't do a thing, you get deprived of it. And I really wanted it. So when I got out of the Navy, I had determined that I really wanted to work in music, and my father gave me the paper and said, "You got to find that rock star job for me." Told him I wanted to be a rock star. And there were two listings in there, one for a country singer and one for a DJ. And I realized this was not going to be easy.
Sure.
And my dad was, you know, he was a realist. He worked for Hawkins, was a physicist. He told me that I needed a new guitar and a car, and he wasn't driving me to the gig. And by the way, the grass was long. You know, that was his hint, like, well, you got to get out there and earn some dough. And so I did go to college for a little bit, and then that really wasn't for me. And I basically, a lot of what I did was learning on the internet and playing in bands around town. And I did that for years and years and years until I came to the end of my rope. And I went to Nashville on a whim, and I came back with my head between my butt, realized that I had gone away from the first thing that I started doing this with, was just playing guitar for the love of it. I got so caught up in trying to make it and do all this and that, and I lost sight of the love, of the joy of the journey. So it was about a year after that trip to Nashville that a producer from Nashville found me and noticed I had something to offer the community. I just needed to get my act together. So I spent the greater part of last year, I lost 65 pounds, started working on my image, and we started tracking together, and that's where Around Again came from. Eric Copeland and I from Creative Soul Jazz, he was a producer in Nashville who worked with a lot of great artists, down there, mostly contemporary Christian and CCM, but he had a jazz heart. And he just took me under his wing and said, why don't we try to create this? And we never knew what was going to happen. We just did it because we loved it. And that's kind of how I got into it.
Well, you know, it's interesting you brought that up, man. You know, I'm a firm believer that, you know, there's no way of creating hit records and, you know, just really get into that zone of writing. And, you know, sometimes the chemistry between two musicians can really bring projects together and you can really close the deals really easily just because you guys are on the same page creatively. And yeah, man, yeah. Having that bond between different writers and musicians, man, is always...
Well, and having someone to produce me, I mean, Eric wrote Only For You on my CD. Everything else I wrote, with the exception of Friend, which is really a hymn, What a Friend in Jesus. I just wanted to do an old hymn, and I've always been fond of old hymns. But having the producer was great because I did my first CD, This Journey, in my studio, which I like. There are things about it I'd love to change, but it's much easier to focus on playing when I don't have to be producer, too.
Definitely.
Because I can just zone and be in there. And Eric could stretch me and challenge me to do things musically that I hadn't thought about doing. Drew, play it this way. That sounds like the same licks you always play. Give me this. And, of course, having the session players, I mean, we have on Astro, Dan Needham played on Astro, and he does sessions with Michael McDonald and with Israel Holton, who is like the big gospel guy who goes around. I mean, Dan plays with everybody. So having him and Gary Lunn on the record just took it to another level, having those live musicians on there to interpret my songs and add their flair to it, you know?
Wow, amazing, man. You know, speaking of session musicians, man, and performing, you've also toured and played along with a lot of great heavy hitters in industry, man. How has that impacted your style as a musician? And I'm pretty sure you definitely got some new chops along the way, man.
Oh, yeah. I did something recently, a benefit for ALS, raising money for ALS and for our record promoter who has ALS. And it was really interesting. I met this person through another person that was helping me with my career. I have to put a plug for a woman named Kim Giles. If people are looking for help with their career, she's fantastic. And she connected me to Deborah Lewa, who was this amazing record promoter who absolutely loved my CD. But they had a benefit for her recently because she has ALS. And I found myself on stage with Boney James, Mindy Hebert, Joey Somerville, and Earl Klugh, of all things.
Oh, wow.
And I'm a huge Earl Klugh fan. I mean, I was, like, ready to, like, you know, I don't know what I was going to do backstage. I was trying to hold it together. But I had learned to his cassettes in the 90s. In the early 90s, I'd gotten into him. And so when you see those guys, one thing that for me, that really inspires me is how down to earth they are. For the longest time, I thought that they were unapproachable because maybe you email them on MySpace and they don't get back to you, and then you sort of feel like, oh, they don't have time for anybody. But now I see how busy they are and what they're doing. It's not that they don't have time. They're very approachable and open. You just got to find them in the right way. So you learn a lot of that from them. I mean, I've played with Nick Colleone a bunch. He's a huge influence of mine. I absolutely love his show and his style of bluesy R&B playing. So, you know, they rub off on you. You're there, and they're real and honest. They talk to you about their gear. They want to know, what are you playing? What picks do you have? What's the new guitar that you're working with? You know?
Oh, yeah. So, oh, yeah. No, I mean, that was a run of the missions I did in my show, man. You know, I love speaking to true gifted and guys who really know their craft as a musician. And you find out the guys who are really focused on their craft, man, they can talk all day long, you know, but
oh, yeah.
You know, about what they do in the studio and performing. And, you know, in the jazz community, man, it's real cool for me, man. I really love centering my career path and conversation around jazz musicians because there's so many blends of styles and experience from these guys starting from the 70s and 80s and 90s and evolving where they're at now. But along the way, you just said it, man, having those different genres of R&B, blues, jazz, gospel, rock.
And they play it all. I mean, a great example, Craig Tukiso, who was in, like, Jefferson Starship as a rock player, is now covering Kenny G songs with an acoustic jazz album, and it's awesome. I mean, you know, I think I give the jazz guys credit for that. You know, especially even the smooth jazz guys who get a bad rap sometimes, but they really can play all the styles.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they really know how to do that, and I think that's the true musician, session guys.
It is.
You know, they really know how to do any style you want.
It is, man, because honestly, if you want to get new chops, you really got to branch out your genre sometimes, you know, because you don't want to become a monotonous arrangement rhythmic player on everything that you do. And I mean, there's different melody structures and different scales outside of R&B and jazz and rock. He started getting into classical, and that's where really things start to change on it. So, you know, just having that diversity of having that ear, you know, tuned to different things out there, I mean, that's just a key benefit as a musician, in my opinion.
And that, yeah, and to me, that's really something that I've been thinking a lot about. I'm writing now for another album I'm going to do in August. I'm going to record another full-length album. And I just finished up a Christmas album called We Three Strings, which has got Tim Bowman and Nick Colleone playing on it.
Nice.
Title track. And, well, Tim just finished up his tracks today, and cross our fingers, knock on wood, next it goes to Nick. He's agreed to play on it. But on the new album, I'm thinking about three things. I'm thinking, one, about how can I incorporate more bridges in my music, and how can I incorporate key changes and modulations in there.
Like,
for example, if the verse is in one key, a good example on my current record, Around Again, is a song called Going Coastal, which has got the verse, has got this D minor 9 flavor with like a G with A in the bass, real smooth, but then the chorus goes to D major. Mm. So it's this great big change from this minor flavor to this major flavor, and that's the current single. And on my first CD, it was the title track, This Journey. All of my verses were in G minor, but my chorus was in A major. So I'm trying to think about that a lot, because there's a lot of guys who are writing real similar stuff, and I think, you know, I just want to do something different. And I'm really inspired by, like, Kelly Minucci, I mean, from Special Effects. He's really writing something different. He's basically taking a Beatles-style pop tune and putting instrumental guitar over it, and he's not using the same chords everybody is, and I like that.
Yeah, I agree, man. You know, guys who really think outside, you know, the traditional scales and chord progressions and arrangements, sometimes you hear so much you almost expect it to go there even before it happens. You know, but you know,
they do it in a way that's still palatable to the ear too.
Yeah,
it's not like John Scofield. You know, he has his audience, but you know, the majority of the people don't understand why he's in B flat and the band is in B or whatever. But you know, those who find a way to do it tastefully.
Yeah, definitely. You know, now we're in a world of DAW recording, Drew, and, you know, you've been tracking for a while, man. What's your preference of analog and DAW, and how are you applying maybe both of those combinations in your setup in your studio?
Well, my studio, I have like a producer's studio. I do have a nice little booth. It's pretty big. I mean, I can fit a drum player in there, although I don't have a tall enough ceiling. But I really enjoy using a Mac, and I enjoy using a program called Logic.
There we go.
And for me, I like this program because, number one, it's really easy for me to operate in there. I grew up on it with Cakewalk and then with Cubase and all that, and then, of course, GarageBand. But Logic does the virtual instruments really well, and when I can record my files to DVD, send them to my producer who's got Logic too, and he'll load them in and he can start changing the sounds. Let me see what it would sound like with, you know, his $1,000 piano plug-in or whatever. And then he can send it off to the drummer. I mean, we did Astro. None of us were in the same room when we did Astro. you know, but it came out so nice. So I'm a big fan of Logic. I like analog stuff. I really like miking my guitars. I just got a new amp, thanks to Eggnator. I'm working with the Eggnator amplifier company now. So I use, like, a Sennheiser mic on an Eggnator amp, and I go through the Apogee interface. And that's kind of my sound. You know, I use plugins, but I really like to just capture that sound with my guitar, minus the reverb. You know, let the engineers do all that. So I'm a big Logic fan.
You're right. And if you don't know, man, I'm a huge, huge Logic advocate.
I discovered it and like it. I mean,
Logic for me, I mean, I've came from the analog world. I've used Pro Tools still currently, just for file exchanging and things when I'm working on different projects. But my foundation for tracking and recording is all Logic. Why? Because I feel that I can tailor my workflow in the studio within Logic very easily. And like you say, all of my instruments are virtual. I run everything virtual. My pianos, my synths, my strings, my basses, everything's coming in virtual. Yeah, it's a huge library. I'm hosting probably maybe 4 gigs of sounds on my template.
Wow, yeah.
But, you know, just having that accessibility of grabbing my sounds right in front of me without loading them up. I love everything preloaded so I can just continue to work fast and track faster. So, yeah, hats off to Logic, man.
I think it's an amazing writing program. And here's the thing, I just have Logic Express, to be honest with you. I don't need a whole lot of things because I'll take my song somewhere else and edit it. But my first trip to Nashville to record with Eric, he bought in his little iMac. And he's like, okay, I'm ready for the session. And I was like, huh? And he was like, I use Logic too, Drew. Load them right in. Yeah. And I thought, you know, that's when I knew, wow, this, you know, and really, you probably know this even more than I do. It's about the user and do you know your tools?
Exactly.
Because you can, you know, because people can use FL Studio and do something really great because they know FL Studio. So, but I'm forever a Logic boy. I think it's easy program. And so I'll start a tune in my basement and get it going, and I'll produce it almost all the way. I'll make it sound real clean. That way, when the studio guys hear the idea, they kind of hear where I was going with it. Oh, I wanted the drums to go halftime here. I wanted the bass, you know, and then I'll just reference something like foreplay or something and say, but I want this kind of sound, you know, take it here. And then that's the best, man, in the studio with those Nashville players.
Yeah, I agree. It's cool, man, for giving an engineer some sort of guide of what you see in your head what the sound should sound like. You know, sometimes I'll get a mix, man, and it's, you know, all over the place, and, you know, the artist really doesn't have a clue of where they would like it to be. You know, so I tell guys sometimes, man, send me a mix close to what you would like it to sound like. I know it's going to be a little bit off, but let me know what it is that you would like to hear, you know, and, you know, I try to capture that the best way I can. So, you know, yeah, I agree with you.
I make mine and my friends are like, so that's your new record. I'm like, no, that's just a demo.
Yeah.
I'm going to take it to Nashville and make it sound hotter. And then on the Christmas album, we paid a guy to mix it. This guy named Bill, I don't have his last name, but he mixed for like Anita Baker and different people. And I can even hear the difference there. My producer is a good mixer. He did a great job on Around Again. We're super excited about it. It's still climbing the charts, but now we've got We Three Strings, which has even got more ears on it. I was in an actual studio and everybody played together at the same time, and it was awesome. And then, of course, they're paying a guy to mix it. A guy whose only job is, I mix. I know how to mix. I tell artists all the time, I'm a big believer of get a lot of ears on your project. If you're mixing and mastering in the same studio and all that, no, you need to hear it through different speakers, and it's really important to, you know, be willing to spend on that because, you know, CDs last a lifetime.
Yeah, I definitely hear. You know, the object, even for tracking every great song, is to capture the song sonically in the mix and, you know, have it translate well over to other systems and make it sound big once it hits the airwaves. So, yeah, man, good choice.
You know, yeah, it's my pet peeve, so.
No, man, that's a good thing to have, man, definitely. You know, with your composition methods, Drew, I got to ask you, man, do you have a specific method that you do for compositions or do you?
I do, actually.
Okay, let's break it down for me.
I am crazy methodic. I'm not usually organized, but I am when it comes to this. And part of what I did on Around Again was I studied, and even for my first CD, This Journey, this was like, I've been playing a long time and been on a lot of projects, and I could saw songs do well and songs not do well, and I began to think about what are the trends, especially if you're, you know, I don't like to write necessarily for radio, but I think about it. I may write a tune and go, man, I think this should be on the radio. When I do, then I follow the trends of smooth jazz radio. Let's use that for an example. They've got three ways they start a song. Some start right on the melody, which would be like my tune Going Coastal, right on the melody. Some tunes start with an intro, and then some tunes start with a hook. And then it's a matter of, I follow like the Beatles, basically. If I start with a hook, then maybe I have a verse, and then maybe I have a pre-chorus and a chorus. And then if I come back to the verse, maybe I come back to a shorter verse, but then the next chorus is a double chorus. You know the group Acoustic Alchemy?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They are fantastic songwriters. I studied them, and I went, man, they got this pattern of if they do two verses in a row in a single chorus, then the next time they do one verse and a double chorus, because now they're ready to feed you the chorus more. And then they would go to a bridge, and they would come out of that, and there's some soloing, and then hammer the chorus again. I mean, if you think about the listener, now oftentimes I'm doing that, and I'm looking at the minutes. You know, man, I'm 4 minutes into this thing, you know, or what's the one thing I want people to remember from this song when it's done? You know, when this song is finished, what's the one thing I want them to get out of it? So I think about that a lot. I study with other writers who are doing, David Benoit, George Benson, Norman Brown, some of these guys, who, you know, James Taylor even,
oh,
the
yeah.
Beatles. I mean, so I'm very methodical about it, and I have a real sense of arranging, too. I think if I wasn't doing this, and maybe I'll do more of this, I'd be an arranger. Because I'm very numerical with what I do. I know that in so many measures, I'm going to add this instrument, and now I'm going to add this, and now I'm going to add this rhythm, and then I'm going to take them out, and I'm going to put them in. And I don't like to show all the guns right away in the beginning.
Right.
So I might show most of the guns, and then I'll break it down and strip it down, and then build it back up again. And so that kind of stuff, just thinking about painting a picture.
No, that's great, man. You know, you brought up one thing, arrangements. I talk about that quite a bit in some of my other interviews. I think it's important for every artist or producer or writer to try some different arrangements. It doesn't always have to be 8 bars, 8-bar chorus, 16. You can do 8-bar solos, 8-bar hooks, and then, do something changing right into the bridge. So a lot of guys are, like you say, they follow the radio format, and they're used to structuring the way they hear on the radio, but
they're too locked up in that.
Yeah, sometimes it doesn't fit though, it's just like, man, there's more time that's left. So it's, again, getting outside that box for arrangement, man. Great.
One group that really caught me off guard with their arranging, and I really have grown to like them, is a band called 480 East.
I've never heard of them.
They have a song called Noodle Soup. It's basically like this guy that does programming and guitar and a percussion guy. That's basically the group, although they sometimes, you'll see them on the road with like Gerald Beasley on bass and Matt Marshak and a drummer, but they had a tune called Noodle Soup, and it just had this hook. And then like instead of where I thought the verse was going to come in, a guitar solo came in. And the next time where I thought the verse was going to come in, a piano solo came in. But they were solos, but they were like a melody, but they were solos. And I think they have done something really neat by mixing club and smooth jazz and pop together. So, I'm always trying to find what's the new thing.
Sure.
Who's out there doing something that I think is cutting edge, where I go, wow, that's really neat. Because, in the end, people are, if we're creating excellent content, the guys are going to find it, and we get out there and we push it. Some guys, like you say, they're so into, got to sound just like what's on the radio. Got to copy that. That's how I get on the radio. And I tell people, no, you write a good song, you get it on the radio.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily have to be that format. It just has to be good. Production has to be high. I'm a part of a website called Broadjam where we review music and stuff. And the biggest comment I had to artists is, bring your production up.
Definitely.
The levels are so drastically different. I have one tune going in my studio, it's so loud, then I hear another, and it's like I can't hear it, Or
no,
the shaker is like at plus 30 dBs. And I'm like, wow.
Right. I was talking to one of my buddies, man. He's a record producer and engineer also. And, I was just going over the conversation of, knowing the tools in your studio is important. Knowing what the limiter does, the functionality, the purpose, when to use it, your compression. I mean, these are the tools that's really going to get your levels up and, to make sure it's not going to, cap out or distort. Take the time, learn the tools, you have them in front of you, start playing around with it. I mean, it's going to be a lot of trial and error and experimentation, but, that'll eliminate the issues of those, one song is louder than the other and too much bass and then less bass.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, I hear that all the time. So.
But it's a learning experience, because I still remember my first CD that I did, I sent it to the mastering guy, and he was like, Drew, your mixes are hot. And I was like, well, that's great. Wow, and he goes, no, Drew, they're too hot. Your levels are too high. He's like, you haven't given me any room to do any mastering. And that's when I had this lesson of, nothing above zero and that whole thing. So I think the more people get and produce, and now the tools are readily available, my biggest concern, something I tell artists a lot, is you don't have to be so quick to put it on the internet. Sit on it a while and mix a while, and maybe get other ears on it, because we're so quick to put stuff up online. A lot of stuff I hear online, it really doesn't excite me.
Oh, yeah. I hear you. Believe me.
And you talk to them, and they look at you like, huh? I'm like, do you don't hear the difference? So we use another forum I'm part of. We use something called the baseball field analogy. If you're going to play single-A ball, that's great. Play single-A ball. If your grandmother loves your music, that's great. You play it for your grandmother,
Right. No,
that kind of thing.
Definitely.
So, and the only way you get to the majors is by being called up. Nobody just invites themselves there. The people hear you and call you up. So I'm a big proprietor of excellence. We're not going to be perfect. That's impossible to do, but I think it is possible with YouTube and different stuff to get better at our craft.
It is. The information's out there on the internet. You can hit the producer's corner with Spud Too Tight. I have a lot of, great engineers out there, man, that really display, what they use in a mix. So, yeah, the tools are available for the masses.
I love YouTube. I get people all the time that tell me the biggest complaint is they don't have money for guitar lessons. And I go, YouTube, it's free. All you have to do is punch in like Frank and Bali and lesson, Larry Carlton and lesson, it's all right there. They've got guys that are itching to get played, and they'll give you lessons. So I'm a big fan of that. I think there's a lot we can do on our own, and that's part of why I think my producer liked me. Nashville, I was kind of a self-starter. So we're just having a blast. The label's called Creative Soul, and he's got a new website now called Next Level Jazz, where he's working with new artists, and we just have a blast. We just create this wonderful music. Nashville session players playing jazz, and they know how to play it, too. They can swing it. They know how to do it all. So,
oh, no, man.
Beautiful.
Nashville has, man, the talent in Nashville as musicians is just, man, it's off the charts. Seriously, man. A lot of guys aren't really familiar. They think it's really just country and western, but yeah, man, these guys are seasoned musicians.
Yeah, it really surprised me. I was worried at first. What would he do to my song? Would it sound CCM or pop or something? And I heard the first track was Bounce. And my friend, horn player Dave Krug, who plays on all my records, went, "Drew, it sounds like Third Force. You got to continue with that guy. That's hot."
Sure.
And Dave is a young kid who's 22 with a fresh ear. So if he liked something and told me it was good, I could trust his fresh young ear. That's another thing I do, too, is I love checking out what the youth say. What are they into? What's fresh for them, you know?
Definitely. You know, Drew, I got to ask you, man, you know, finding that zone for creativity, do you find that being in a stage, gravitating off the audience and your band members, or really being in a studio environment where you can focus on your compositions?
I think it's both. I love playing live. I love recording too, but I love playing live. If I picked one, it would always be playing live because I feed off of the audience. I'm usually wireless on my guitar, and I usually never know what direction a song is going to go until we start it. I mean, we have a roadmap, but it's, you know, I feed off the last song I did, off the last performer, so I get a lot of energy, definitely a lot of energy live, and the musicians that I have. I was in Los Angeles recently out there at a club called Spagatini, and also in San Diego, and I had Larry Carlton's drummer, Jeffrey Osborne's keyboard player, and Frankie Beverly and the May's bass player, Larry Kempel.
Wow.
Then I had this crazy, and that was just, for me, that was a joy, because those musicians are, it's such a high level, they make you play well. You do stuff and you watch your own YouTube video and go, "Wow, I didn't realize I played that." But, you know, so it's the conversation between the musicians, though.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas, so I say in both places I find it. Now, it's different for me when I'm creating in the studio, because if I'm doing the whole tune, like I'm working on a tune now called Catalina Blue, and I'm working on a Bruce Hornsby piano part. Not a piano player, but I hear it. So I like that, too, because in that case, I'm in charge of the whole composition. So I can affect everything exactly how I hear it, you know, and then send it off. And then the next part is to trust those session players and say, you know what, I know they're going to do great. Why? Because they're professional drummers. They've been drumming their whole life, you know.
Yeah,
it's hard to let go sometimes.
Right. No, I totally agree with you, man. You know, so what's on the musical agenda for 2010, Drew?
So what we did, 2009 actually, Around Again came out, right after this Journey came out. I re-released my first CD after I lost all my weight with new art, so it could get on the same label. Then I released Around Again. Then now, coming up in the next few months, We Three Strings is going to release. It's a Christmas album of all hymns, done either smooth or traditional. It's got upright bass, live acoustic piano, Hammond B3 organ, I mean, it's got everything on there. Then, right at the start of 2011, is going to be another album coming out. So a lot of touring going on this summer. I'm going out to Wisconsin, Appleton, Wisconsin, in August. Then I'm going back to Catalina Island to play again, this time with Eric Darius. Last time I was on the same night as George Duke, so we'll be out in San Diego. I'm working with a really cool guitar builder who builds guitars that have a glass fret and fretboard and nut and saddle. Everything the strings touch is glass.
Wow.
So that's probably the coolest thing I'm doing this year. And the sustain is so crazy, it's affecting my writing. I mean, I just can do things on that guitar that I couldn't ever do on a regular guitar. So the company is called Glass Tones, and the builder is Mark Payung, and he's got a patent for all stringed instruments, violins, everything. He's starting with two guitars, so I'm his number one endorsed artist, and just came back from Nashville and NAMM, where I did a showcase down there, and it's an incredible guitar. So I'm into the future of where is it going to, you know, musically, but also where's the equipment going, so.
Oh, man, that's hot, man.
It's a crazy guitar, and he does backlays instead of inlays. So there's no inlays. You put whatever graphics you want behind the glass fretboard.
Oh,
and you can do, like, GE touch-sensitive technology eventually, too. So, you know, a rock band could have it lighting up when they play faster. But its tone is unmatched. There isn't any guitar in the world probably that has a sound like this, because it's highly dense silicon material fired at 1800 degrees, and because the string is always touching glass, it's an even tone. It's Duane Allman squared. Instead of the glass slide on the string, it's the string on the glass.
What kind of pickups are you using on those?
He's got, well, what's going to be in the custom one he's building for me? I have a prototype now. There are two in the world, and I have this prototype that I'm testing. Mine is going to have Lindy Fralins in it, and supposedly Lindy Fralins actually hand-winding pickups for me to match my sound according to my CD. He can see the sound I'm after, and he's wanting them. There'll be coil splitters. So it's a traditional guitar with a wood body and a wood neck. It's just that the strings always rest on two points of highly dense silicon material. So what Mark did was purify the string vibration. When you pluck a string, it vibrates, it oscillates, but there's no gray haze around the note. No unwanted frequencies. So the chords just sound beautiful. When I play A, I just hear the A note. And you can make a note ring as long as you want on the distorted sound, and not just A, but like C sharp. I can bend a high C sharp and just have it ring the whole time we have a conversation almost.
Wow.
Endless. It's very cool. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, notes that might sustain 6 seconds on a regular guitar, maybe he gets 18 or 20 seconds on his guitar or longer.
That is insane.
I mean, it opens, yeah, it's really cool. I know. Producers would really be into it because it'd be great for R&B, but you can play all styles on it, jazz, rock. I mean, at the showcase, we did everything from Hendrix to jazz to Chicken Pickin' to Leonard Skinner. I mean, everybody was playing on the prototype, you know.
Wow.
Shred guys. They all were playing on it. I mean, all through the same amp with the same distortion sound and clean sound and getting all those tones. So
amazing.
That's my new thing, is I'm really interested in what Glass Tones is doing.
Well, Drew, it's been a pleasure having you on my show, man. We'd love to have
you
back and talk about your new endeavors, your new guitars, man. I definitely want to hear that, man. I got
to
see that.
Yeah, I'll have to send you an audio clip. I did on my Christmas album, I did a couple tunes with it, including a version of Oh Holy Night with three tracks of Glass Tone guitars on there. So we're excited about that. And, of course, in 2011, the new album is going to come out with, you know, all the Glass Tone guitars on it. So, it's really exciting. I mean, it's scary to be the new builder. You know, some people don't understand the guy, but, you know, I'm banking on him. I think he could very well be the next Les Paul, possibly.
Wow.
He's got something really innovative. I mean, everybody's playing 50s and 60s technology, wood bodies, wood necks,
sure,
all of that. You know, and this is not a carbon fiber guitar. It does not sound crazy or weird. It's just that he's got, instead of having new pedals, this guitar makes amps sound good. I mean, I take it and I test amps and I go, oh, that's what that amp sounds like. So, yeah, it's definitely been a pleasure to be on here. Your podcast is awesome. I wish you much success with it, you know?
Oh, appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Well, yeah, man.
Well, Drew, we'll keep in touch, man. And, man, I want to check out that audio clip when you get it. So we'll be in touch, man.
Yeah, we will. I've got your email, so we will. And folks are welcome to go to Glass Tones. I think he's got a MySpace and all that, but he needs me to do his audio clips. He did them, and the interesting thing is the more I have this guitar, the more I learn what it can do. The more I can sustain notes, the longer I hold them, other applications I find. So it's a brand new time. It's a new renaissance for musicians.
I think it's,
you know, our job to just take it to a new level.
I totally agree, man. Congratulations with that endorsement. That's phenomenal.
Yeah, it's you know, you get one and then you start to get others. So.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Martin will be sending me a guitar in a couple days. So.
Really? Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. Man, you're just flooded, man, with good toys, man.
I don't know. Yeah.
Well, Drew, you have a safe and a safe new year, man, and continue to the best of luck to you with your CD.
Thank you very much.
All right, man. You take it easy, man.
You too. You have a great day.
You too.
Sure, bye.
And a big shout out to Drew Davidson for coming on the show and chopping it up with me, man. Again, truly an honor speaking to another seasoned musician who's collaborated on various projects and really just stands out as a guitarist, man. He has such a diverse background musically for listening to many different styles of music, and he's incorporating that all into one style, and which is real hot, man, because, you know, he's pulling from so many other great seasoned musicians who's inspired him as a musician growing up. So again, hats off to Drew Davidson. And for more information on Drew Davidson, you need to check out his website at www.drewdavidson.com, and it's www.drewdavidson.com. davidsen.com. Again, www.drewdavidson.com. And for my past and current interviews, you can hit my new website up at spud2tight.blogspot.com. Again, that's spud2tight.blogspot.com. And I also host a podcast on iTunes, so if you have an iPhone or a computer, pull up your iTunes player, go to the iTunes store, and type in the Producers Corner, click on my image, and you'll have a list of my past and current interviews as well. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in and listening in. Until next time, you guys keep it tight. Peace.